Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Next Tuesday marks the 150th anniversary of the start of one of the biggest battles of the American Civil War, the Second Battle of Bull Run, otherwise known as Second Manassas. The fight at Bronner Farm, or Groveton, took place on August 28, 1862, and featured several brigades that were part of a division led by an influential Wisconsinite named General Rufus King. At the outset of the Civil War, King was authorized to raise up a Wisconsin regiment that would later become the Iron Brigade. He was later promoted to command the division that included the brigade. It saw its first action at Second Bull Run when it came under surprise attack by Confederate forces under Stonewall Jackson. But it's the story of the Iron Brigade, at that point only known as the Black Hats, under the command of Brigadier General John Gibbon, that we bring you today. Lake Effect Civil War contributor and author Thomas Martin Sobotky tells the story of the 2nd, 6th, and 7th Wisconsin Volunteer Regiments among the Black Hats who fought so courageously during the battle.
The brigade called it Bronner Farm because the action mainly occurred on the farm of a John Bronner. You have to understand this battle occurred a day or two before the second great battle of Bull Run on the very same battlefield as the year before. And half of the Confederate Army under Thomas Jonathan Jackson, otherwise known as Stonewall, 25,000 plus strong, were along a railway embankment hidden. The railway hadn't been finished near Manassas. They raided a depot of Union supplies and plundered it, burned the rest, and then went into hiding on this railroad embankment, and somehow the entire Union Army couldn't find them.
Now we'll raise a rebel yell and send them Yankees straight to hell. We'll give them peep shot, buck and ball. We'll march and we'll fight for old Stonewall.
And part of that army was marching up a turnpike towards Centerville, which is a city just south and west of Washington, D.C. in Virginia. They're passing close to Groveton, a small town. And Gibbon was up with the 6th Wisconsin up in the lead, like a good leader should be. There had been some skirmishing. The men could hear a little light musketry way up ahead, the thump of a cannon once in a while. So part of the army up ahead of them was their corps was encountering some Confederate skirmishers, but they didn't get worried about it because it was a common occurrence. And they frankly thought there was nothing going to happen that day. And Gibbon put his glasses on a hill where he saw some movement, and he saw groups of brown horses, all beautifully colored the same, and it kind of bothered him. He thought at first it was a cavalry patrol, and it's definitely Confederate. But when the horses made a classic turn, a kind of looping turn, well, he's an artillery commander originally. He wrote a manual for the entire U.S. Army to follow on artillery. He, within a split second, knew that that was a battery of guns coming into battery, as it's called. They unlimber the guns, and the guys go right to them, and they start shooting. And it seemed to Gibbon and some of the men up front that the first 6 or 7 shells to come through over them, over the turnpike, and rather close, too, they kind of did a nice long bow as the screaming shells came over. It happened all at once, and frankly, the men were shocked. They were totally taken by surprise. Gibbon himself admitted it. They were all scared to death because, like, what's going on? They were not ready for it.
Jackson's in the valley, Stonewall is on the loose. Jackson's in the valley, all hell's a breaking loose. Jackson's in the valley, Stonewall is on the loose. Jackson's in the valley, all hell's a breaking loose.
Jackson had had a chance to see this particular brigade coming up the pike. And undoubtedly, those brand new frock coats and hat uniforms made them look like a bunch of what were called fresh fish, guys that hadn't seen any action. And he had gotten 5 of his brigades, some of the best units in the entire Confederate Army, lined up, 5,000 plus men, 5,300 men. And Gibbon had less than 2,900 in this brigade. And these guys were going to be easy pickings. They marched well. Gibbon's men always were closed up in ranks. They weren't lazy marchers because they'd been taught well for those months in camp. And he went and sent the 2nd Wisconsin right away into the woods and through the Bronner property. There were outbuildings, a barn, and the farm. You could see, you know, the farmhouse. He the first thing he'd done when he'd seen the guns going into batteries, he sent an aide back at the full gallop asking for battery B, which is at the rear of his brigade, to come up at the gallop. You know, no messing around. I want him up here right now. And so he'd done everything right. He wanted to send the 2nd Wisconsin in to capture those guns, and they would have a little ways to go. The 2nd Wisconsin was his best regiment because they had been in a battle. Colonel Edward O'Connor, a man from Beloit, who was West Point, and kind of suspected because he had so many friends from the South, he was kind of suspected of being not quite loyal, and it really bothered him. But they got in with skirmishers out ahead of the main body in just a couple of minutes and met skirmishers from the Confederate Army. But before the 2nd Wisconsin really even had a chance to get properly in a kind of frame of mind, this is a battle, they had five Confederate regiments on them and surrounding them. And they were coming on in three lines. And they just stood their ground and gave them every volley of musketry they could shoot, you know, very well-directed musketry by O'Connor. But when you're outnumbered 5 or 6 to 1, it's not looking good. And a lot of men went down in the 2nd. The 2nd suffered horribly at Brawner Farm. Luckily, the 7th Wisconsin intermingled with them and came in on their flank to try to help. And essentially what the battle looked like to a lot of Wisconsin soldiers in the brigade there was shoot as fast and as accurately as you can and reload and do it again as fast as you can. After the first couple of volleys, it was, you know, fire at will, and it's as fast as you can load and shoot. They were very good with firearms, so they hit their targets. The problem was they had these Austrian rifles called the Lorenz. Even the Union Army had been forced to go over to Europe and buy extra muskets because they needed so many so fast. And these muskets apparently were clumsy in loading. So these guys, you know, in the whole brigade, these guys were not happy with them. They got fouled more easily, which means that every time you fire a shot, a little bit of the powder at the bottom doesn't burn, and it collects at the breech of the rifle. And after 20 or 30 rounds, you're getting to a point where ramming the bullet in and getting it to sit properly so you can get a really good shot off is very difficult. One 2nd Wisconsin soldier in exasperation said to an officer, you know, that my musket's fouled and I can't shoot this thing. I want to get these guys coming on. And where can I get another musket? And, of course, it was real clear to both the officer and the man that, well, you just go find one of your dead comrades, which is really sad, and get his musket, you know, and get some extra ammunition, and it won't be as fouled. It was that intense. The main fight developed at a range of anywhere from 50 to 70 yards. That is very close, and that's bad for the Confederates too. But of course, they're veterans, and they're the best troops that General Lee and Jackson have in the entire army. So they're up against the very best Confederates. The Confederates are coming down at them on higher ground, but they aren't budging. The Confederates get very confused by this because they are the best soldiers in the army and they have so many men, but these guys just, who are these guys? It didn't occur to them that they could break and run. If they were ordered to stand and fight, well, they're just going to do it. They're that stubborn. And it is stubbornness, no question about it. What happens is that they fight for almost 2 hours in this condition, back and forth, with tremendous casualties. Lysander Cutler, a New Yorker who settled in Wisconsin, a colonel of the 6th, gets hit in the leg on horseback and has to go to the rear. He's very badly wounded. He'll survive and actually command another brigade. Edward Bragg, the lieutenant colonel, takes over and does brilliantly. Major Tom Allen in the second gets hit badly and refuses to be taken from the field. Colonel O'Connor is either mortally wounded or dead. A lot of guys are down, but they won't budge. In fact, in some places, they did have to move back a little bit so that they could allow the reinforcements in the brigade to get up to them. But they did not give. And, of course, darkness was a big help to both sides. And they fought on till 9 in the evening, till it, even in darkness, trying to look at the muzzle flashes. But you have to wonder what the Confederates were thinking, because all the men and officers knew that they had tremendous firepower and they had every advantage. And this one lone Union brigade was holding. Now, at dark, other troops from up front in the column and behind them came up, but it was over. And they had stood their ground. They had really, all of them had seen the elephant. So this wasn't just seeing the elephant. This was as an intense battle. In fact, the Confederates they captured all said, "You outnumber us." You know, and it was just amazing to these soldiers that, are you kidding? You know, I mean, we got one regiment with our battle flag, and we're looking at five of your battle flags, and we kind of figure at the opening of this battle, you got us. General Ewell, who is next to Jackson in his corps, the best general they got, loses a leg as a result of Groveton, misses months and months. After Jackson's death the next year, he is leading Jackson's old corps, and he was supposed to take the heights beyond Gettysburg and doesn't. And I wonder if it wasn't Mrs. Brown, who he married in the winter while he was nursing his missing leg, but it might have been something he lost because of some Wisconsin men the year before. But this was a tough situation. Gibbon knew, unlike General Rufus King, who I think has a high school named after him, was the division commander. You know, this all comes in here. This is all interconnected. Wanted to go march ahead, according to his orders, right to where the Confederates were. And Gibbon very smartly said, "I don't think we better do that. And let's pull back toward Manassas Junction, where we know they're not, in hopes of finding the rest of the army," which they did the next day. And on the second day, they were instrumental in holding back the charging Confederates to allow a good part of the Union Army to get out of there.
Pewaukee resident, historian, and teacher Thomas Martin Sobotky is the voice and brains behind our Iron Brigade and Beyond Wisconsin in the Civil War series, produced by Stephanie Lecce. Sobotky is also author of the book Across That Dark River, The Civil War Memory, published by Moving Train Books. Keep listening, TGIFFF. That's right, thank goodness, it's Flash Fiction Friday. Our theme is Jubilation, and it comes your way next on Lake Effect.